I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. Summer of 2023 was all eyes on Africa between the massive BRICS summit, which saw the admission of new members and the application of dozens more to join the bloc, to the multiple coups that broke out in former French colonies. We'll take a bird's eye view into the de facto leader of the continent, South Africa. All right, let's get into the MO. It was all eyes on South Africa this summer as the BRICS summit was the invite that everyone in diplomatic circles wanted to receive. Had Vladimir Putin attended in person, this would have been the second time he'd have seen Ramaphosa just this year alone.
The war cannot go on forever. All wars have to be settled and come to an end at some stage. And we are here to communicate a very clear message that we would like this war to be ended.
Putin and Ramaphosa sparred, as some described it, earlier in the summer when an African delegation went to St. Petersburg in June to present their ideas on a peace plan for Moscow and Kiev. Now, speculation looming on whether or not Putin would attend in person due to that questionable International Criminal Court arrest warrant that was issued. South Africa, the host nation, is a signatory to the ICC. They had signaled that they would not abide by the agreement should Vladimir Putin attend. But Putin joined by video link instead to avoid making this summit about himself and focus more on the mission of the group. Meanwhile, at home, President Ramaphosa is facing an uphill battle to remain in power as he and the ANC party begin to lose popularity. Joining us to discuss all of this is Clinton Enzala. He is a journalist and political analyst and commentator at African Stream. He is joining us now from Nairobi, Kenya. Thank you for joining us, Clinton. So first, let's discuss the BRICS summit. This year, it was hosted by South Africa. There were a lot of controversies surrounding this summit. So let's first start with that rumor that French President Emmanuel Macron was hinting at wanting an invite to the summit. Now, France is not a member state. Was this a deliberate move by Macron to sort of put Ramaphosa in this awkward position? And obviously, Macron didn't get that invite. So was that the right move on South Africa's part, especially now, given that the recent junta coup d'etats in other African states who were former French colonies?
Yeah, first of all, I agree. I think definitely it was an attempt to put Ramaphosa in an awkward position by the request that Macron made. Because like you said, one, France is not a member of the BRICS summit. But I think that idea they could have asked to go as a guest, which wouldn't have been very strange. But I think what makes it very strange is that among the demands that they've made for Macron to attend the BRICS summit is that Putin should not attend. So this is strange considering that Putin has got a right to be there because Russia is a member of BRICS and France has got no right to be there. But now it is actually France which went ahead and started making demands, which is very strange. It's like your friend at the office has got a wedding, they're having a wedding, and you are not on the guest list, but you insist that you're asked to be put on the guest list. But among one of the conditions is that one of their cousins, who is like part of the organizing committee of the wedding, should not attend. So it's very strange, I think, as a guest, if you, in the first place, if you had no right to be there, you should be the least person to make demands. First of all, if the host and the other members decide that they can allow you to attend, it should be at their own discretion. It should be on their own terms. Now here we see this arrogance from Macron, where first of all, you're not supposed to be there. Then you're asking that you should go there. But instead of just waiting to say, gentlemen, if you find it acceptable that I do come, you let me know. You go ahead and make your own demands to say, I can only come if you do A, B, C, D. I think it's like a lot of arrogance, and it also shows that probably he doesn't even want to be there. He just wanted to find a method of undermining the summit, creating more controversy around the summit, and literally just throwing a spanner in the organizing of the summit. So, because what we've seen now, that ideally, like a summit of this magnitude, Everyone should have been looking at issues that are going to be discussed at this summit. There are a number of countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, a number of countries that have expressed interest into joining BRICS. And these are issues that are going to be discussed at this summit. But unfortunately, because of this drama that is surrounding the attendance of people like Macron who want to attend, the attendance of Putin, and whether South Africa is going to arrest him, has, I think, taken the focus away from the nitty-gritties of the summit on issues that a lot of us should be looking at, a lot of issues that a lot of media houses should be examined. So now we have been forced to focus on the froth and not the beer. So yeah, so people, I think they are now minoring, they are majoring on minors and minoring on the majors. So it's unfortunate. And I think, yeah, so Macron has made it worse by adding more drama to a situation which was already dramatic. I think what we've seen so far of where up now is not yet clear if President Putin is going to attend or he's not going to attend, because we had stories to say at one time President Ramaphosa had requested him, had meant to say he should not attend or maybe he should attend virtually. There are also suggestions that Sapo had thought maybe the summit should be moved to another country like China. So like I've said, all this drama has taken away focus from other issues around, to say, at the summit, are we going to see the introduction of the BRICS currents? Are we going to see more countries added to the BRICS group, and what shape that is going to take? So I think these are many issues that have now been pushed into the peripherals, they've been pushed into the corner, and these are issues that probably should have, the world should have also been discussing. But I think that probably the West, who from the beginning, they don't want to see BRICS succeed, because it's a threat to the hegemony. So to some extent, I think all this drama around it works in their favor.
So South Africa is also a member state to the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Now, months ago, the ICC issued an arrest warrant for the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, over the alleged kidnapping of Ukrainian orphans. We've heard from South African officials, such as the foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, and ANC Secretary General Fikile Mbalula, who said they would have waived this warrant in favor of Putin actually attending the summit. Now, obviously, he didn't go in person, so they were not put in this tough position. But were there any repercussions to them on the international stage for this position that they took? I mean, did The Hague respond in any way?
Definitely. I think, one, like I have said on a number of forums, that anyone who expects to see Putin in handcuffs if you travel to South Africa, they are naive. Actually, they are hallucinating. No such thing is going to happen. So like I've said, one, South Africa has made it clear to say as a host nation, they're not going to arrest Putin. So, and then number two, first of all, like if you see the sentiment that comes from most political leaders in South Africa, before even talking about whether they are going to arrest Putin or not, is how the ICC is being seen in South Africa. First of all, the court has been discredited and it has done most of this to itself. So there's no chance that Putin is going to be arrested. I think the South Africa is just going to ignore the warrant. It's unfortunate that they've been put in this position. But like I say, the South African government, which is, well, of course, the government derives power from the political party, which is the ANC. And Fikile Mbalula is the Secretary General of the ANC, so he's the chief administrative office of the ANC. Most of the policies implemented by the South African government come from the ANC. And I think that if the party has indicated that Putin is not going to be arrested, that he's welcome to South Africa, he's going to be a free man, I do not see the government departing from that position and arresting Putin. So there's a very high chance of us seeing, I think, snow in Libya or somewhere in the Sahara Desert than seeing Putin in handcuffs. And of course, there's going to be backlash from the ICC. But it's what extent can do? I mean, like, what can they do to South Africa? Like, what punishment are they going to enforce on South Africa? So it's going to show a lot of, one, the biasness. And I think if they took a very harsh position in South Africa, it's also going to add fuel on the cause. Because there have been numerous calls from a lot of people in South Africa, a lot of important people, prominent political leaders, calling for the country to withdraw from the ICC, which they've said is little has been reduced to a tool used by Western countries to fix some countries that they see as enemies or they perceive as enemies. So if the ICC, if there's backlash against South Africa, it's going to give impetus to those calls for the country to pull out of the ICC. because I mean, those calls have already gained a lot of momentum to say this court is discredited. It's seen to be unequal. I can say that majority of the people who've been indicted by the ICC are people from Africa and now a few people from Russia. So, I mean, like, the world is no longer blind. People can see to say a lot of leaders in the West have committed crimes more against their own people, but mostly in other foreign lands. We've seen there was that incident where the ISIS wanted to prosecute certain US soldiers for crimes that they committed against civilians in Afghanistan. The US government shielded them. We've seen Israel bomb Palestine on numerous occasions. We've not seen people clamoring to say Israeli leaders like Benjamin Netanyahu should be prosecuted. So it becomes very difficult for any sane person to see the ICC as a fair court, as a court which judges everyone equally. So seeing that some animals are more equal than others in the face of the ICC. Therefore, it becomes very difficult for the court to gain prominence across, especially in the global south, where people are seen to say they are victimized. So even before we go into the elements of whether someone is guilty or not, people ask questions to say, it can't be that it's only African leaders who've committed this kind of crimes, or maybe leaders from Eastern Europe. So first of all, that's what makes it hard for the court. If a court doesn't have credibility, it becomes very hard even for South Africa to enforce that warrant. Because even among their own citizenry, it's only a small minority of people and who, for obvious reasons, they align with the West. Those are the only people who are clamoring for the arrest of Putin. But if you go into Johannesburg, you go into Durban, and you talk to an ordinary South African to say, do you think the government should arrest Putin? Most of the people say no. So I think if they arrest Putin, the government will not only be going against its own party, but also against what the views and wishes of the majority of their citizens.
All right, coming up next, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa was embroiled in a financial scandal that had some critics convinced that Sofagate was proof of corruption. We'll discuss it when we return with Clinton and Zales at Type MO. We'll be right back.
Since World War II, the United States has fostered extremist anti-Russian prejudices and hatreds among the Ukrainian diaspora in at least Canada, the United States, and countries in Eastern Europe, probably everywhere in the world. It doesn't matter what these groups say or do. It will support them if the groups are causing hatred and chaos within the target country.
Вся ідеологія Майдану, вона якраз була чисто сектантська ідеологія.
Серед військовослужбовців вооружених формувань України велике кількість лиць, які придерживаються язичних ритуалів.
Ми не християнці, ми язичники.
So the CIA uses anyone and anything. If there's a religion,
welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. So every year, millions of people lose things in the couch cushions regularly. Do your spring cleaning and you'll find, a cell phone, remote controls, loose change, old snacks. But how about $500,000 in cash? That was just one of the fights Cyril Ramaphosa was facing, losing big money in the sofa. Clinton Enzala is back with us to discuss it. Thank you for sticking around, Clinton. So let's get into these domestic affairs within South Africa. Cyril Ramaphosa was not that long ago charged with a corruption scandal, more than $500,000 worth. He was recently cleared of any wrongdoing. But can you tell us more about that case that many outlets have called SofaGate?
Okay, yeah, so this case, infamously known as the Palapala scandal. So Palapala is the name of a firm that President Cyril Ramaphosa owns in Limpopo province, which is north of Johannesburg. So actually the case, apparently it occurred in 2020, but it only came to the public attention in 2022. So the story is that some criminals who were in cahoots with one of the domestic workers at the farm stole about 500, according to Ramaphosa, they stole $580,000 that was stashed in a sofa at the farm. So, but according to the whistleblower, the person who brought this case into to the public attention, Arthur Fraser, who is a former South African senior intelligence official, he claims up to $4 million was stolen. They say this money was, it was stashed in the sofa, like he said. Then these workers, when they stole the money and Ramaphosa discovered the theft, he did not report to the police. But he instructed one, he reported it to his head of security, who somehow constantly had those criminals or those individuals rounded up, tortured, and they returned some of the money. Then they were paid some money to, as a way of maybe getting them not to talk about the case so that they can keep it away from the public, to keep it as a secret. So other friends have reported Ramaphosa, one, for they said that could have been money laundering. Then two, he also, they say he contravened the Crime Prevention Act. Because they say, one, if you observe a crime or you are aware that the crime has been committed somewhere and you don't report it to the police, it's a criminal offense. Then also the issues of to say the money, if you're keeping 4 million, let us say, even if it's 580,000, if you're keeping money in a sofa, it raises this question to say, how did you earn money? Because money that you've earned legitimately, you're going to deposit it in the bank like other normal people do. Then two, it also says, have you paid taxes on that money? So these are the issues that led Arthur Fraser to report Ramaphosa. So in the inquiry that was conducted by the Office of the Public Protector, which they've cleared Ramaphosa, so they say there was no wrongdoing. They say Ramaphosa, when he discovered the theft, he reported to his head of security. His head of security, who is a police officer. So they say by default of that, then he replied to the head of security. And unfortunately, the junket has now been thrown at the doorstep of the head of security, who they say maybe he should have reported it to other officers high up. So, but all in all, it dented Ramaphosa's reputation, because Ramaphosa got into office when former President Jacob Zuma was impeached on alleged corrupt activities. So Ramaphosa came on a platform to say he was going to rid the ends of corruption, a tag that has, like, I think now been associated with a party more like almost every year, every month, there are new corruption scandals. So Ramaphosa in 2018, when he became the head of the ANC and the Republican president, it was on a platform of change, on the change to say the ANC now, we are turning the party around, there will no longer be these allegations of corruption. But now a few years down the line, he's equally in the same position as his predecessor, where he's stuck by corruption allegations.
Mr. Ramaphosa's party, the ANC, still maintains a majority in the 400-seat parliament, but it appears that the opposition party, EFF, is gaining traction among voters in the country. Did the money scandal that we called SofaGate impact party popularity at all? And can you explain for us the fundamental differences between these two parties?
Yeah, so first of all, I think the money scandal, the SofaGate scandal, definitely is going to have a dent in the performance of the ANC. But unfortunately, the ugly truth is that, well, the ANC is already associated with so much corruption that people are no longer shocked when they hear of such scandals. Like most people, they've already kind of come to accept to say corruption is very common, widespread in the ANC. And yeah, it spells a lot of trouble for the ANC. First of all, this is the party whose support has been declining in previous, I mean, in the recent elections. So, for instance, the last elections that the ANC won was 2019, and the party polled 57% of the national votes. That was a drop of about 5%, because in 2014, they had polled around 62%. So even their seats in parliament have dropped from 249 seats in 2014 to 230 seats in 2019. So it shows that the party has been bleeding a lot of support. It's losing support, and a lot of people like they've lost hope in the ANC. And it's a reason why a lot of them are moving towards the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, which is being seen as it's a radical version of the ANC, because the EFF leadership, like in Julius Malema, they came from the ANC. He was the firebrand youth leader of the ANC. And many other people who moved with him to the EFF are people who feel that the ANC has moved from its radical positions. It started first with moving to the center, and to the extent where they feel to say it's now actually beginning to move to the right. So the EFF, like I said, it's a radical version of the ANC. It's a party which still sticks to the old ANC doctrine, those policy decisions that the ANC had committed itself to during the liberation struggle. Things like the land distribution, which is a very contentious issue, because you're in a country where the black people are over 70%. They represent 70% of the population, but they own just around 10% of the land in the country. So these are the issues which the ANC had committed itself to resolve. But after being in power for now 3 decades, not much change has happened, and it looks like the party is dragging its feet. So I think those are the issues that differentiates from the ANC, from the EFF, is that the ANC has reneged on a lot of promises, on a lot of commitments that had sold to the black population who supported them through and through during the liberation struggle. So a lot of people who feel that the ANC has not delivered and they are losing hope, they are crossing over to the EFF, which they feel that it represents the concerns and the aspirations of many black people. So, yeah.
Now, lastly, on the topic of energy independence for Africa as a continent, so despite South Africa being the continent's largest economy, it too suffers from many rolling blackouts. Energy is perhaps the biggest single driver for economies. There are a lot of infrastructure projects being worked out between the African Union and China. How do you see those various partnerships panning out in the years to come in this pan-African view of it?
All right. So I think So one aspect which I wanted to highlight to say the relationship between China and Africa, like this partnership, I think it gained prominence in 2000, but China had been in Africa much earlier. I think one of the earliest projects that they undertook, which was taken in Zambia in the 1970s, the Tanzania-Zambia Railways, where at the height of when you had apartheid in South Africa, the colonial government in Zimbabwe, Zambia, which is dependent on copper, could not export its copper. It needed through Zimbabwe or through South Africa to reach the ports. It needed an alternative link to the sea. And the only way was through Tanzania to the port of Dar es Salaam. And Zambia approached a number of Western governments, and they all turned down the request. They say it was unfeasible and everything. No one was willing to undertake the project. It was China that came aboard in the 70s, before China was even the superpower that it is today, before it was this economic house. It helped to build this rail line from Dar es Salaam into the copper belt in Zambia. And it also helped to put a pipeline so that Zambia could continue to access oil from after it could no longer access the port of Beira because of the situation with the then Southern Rhodesia. So China didn't get into Africa in the 2000s. It has been there. And if it's been there for all these years and it never attempted to colonize any country, it's not going to do it now. And then you hear all these plans. You know, sometimes a lot of lies are spread. You'll be told, oh, Zambia has taken over the airport China has taken over the airport in Zambia and whatever. But when you go on the ground, you realize to say there's no such thing. And unfortunately, a lot of anti-China agendas, whatever, are being driven in the media and sometimes by people who've not even bothered to go on the ground and verify these claims. So like I've said, the relationship with China, there's still room for improvement. And I think that there are still a lot of things that to be worked on. But I believe to say they can be worked on without totally ending the relationship. If there's a snake in your house, you don't burn the whole house to get rid of the snake. You find means of getting the snake from the house or maintaining the house. So like I said, those challenges that we have in the relationship with China, we should find means of addressing them while still enhancing the relationship. Because this is like one most important thing to say, when countries are able to access alternative finance from China to fund this project, it means it gives some breathing space. Instead of getting money which was earmarked for education or for health, they will get that money from China to build a road. So they are at that moment, they built the road and they are still able to fund their health and education budget, which would have been impossible because it means if they are not able to access that finance, they are going to be forced between building a rail line, building an airport, and funding health and education. So when there's an alternative finance, it means that it gives this government room to maneuver, to say, because only someone who is naive, someone who is dishonest, would dispute that Africa needs to improve its, these infrastructure projects that they're doing. They are needed. I think for the country to be able to lift most of their people from poverty, to become a middle-income continent by 2035, 2050, it needs to develop its infrastructure to modern standards. So, and the only way that, like I said, if we didn't have alternative finances, it would mean it would have to go into the coffers and touch money which was meant for other needy sectors of the economy.
Yeah, as they say, when the Chinese come, you get a road or a bridge. When the Americans come, you get a lecture. Clinton Nzala, political commentator at African Stream, thank you so much for your analysis today. All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.